This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Each year since 1983, the Division of Military Education presents the Presidential Pass-in Review, during which dignitaries walk the line of the Boston University Corps of Cadets. Then the combined Army, Navy, and Air Force Reserve Officer Training Corps units march in review. This year, following the ceremony, war correspondent Joseph Galloway delivered the first Pershing Lecture on Military History at Morse Auditorium. Galloway, co-author of the story of the first full-scale infantry battle of the Vietnam War in the Yadrang Valley in 1965, spoke of his experiences there. Here are excerpts from that speech, and we'll follow them with conversation with two other veterans of that war, Carlo Durante and Andrew Basevich. Here is Joseph Galloway.
In the course of some 40 years as a reporter, I've spent years, not months, with the military in the field. I have, in that misspent career, generally tended to hang with the infantry. Some might think that foolish, if not perverse. But there was always method in my madness. With the infantry, life is fairly simple and straightforward. You get a mission to arrive at a particular location on a map, and at the end of the day, you're either standing on that piece of ground, rifle in hand, holding it for America, or you aren't. Events tend to happen close enough so that I can see them, and slowly enough that even I can understand them. Most important of all, no one at the point of the spear, no one at battalion level or below, ever lied to me. There is no point in lying when one is within sound of the guns. That's an art better practiced in the rear. But there are some drawbacks to hanging with the infantry. In my time in their company, I've personally been bombed, rocketed, strafed, and napalmed by the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Marines, U.S. Army Aviation, and the air forces of the nations of South Vietnam, Laos, India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. I don't consider myself an inconsiderable target, and yet here I am, ready to talk. Nothing damaged beyond my dignity. In the event that there may be present or former winged warriors among you, I hasten to add that I hold no grudges against those who attacked me and missed. Often I am asked what Vietnam meant to me and what it means to me today. And often I answer by relating this anecdote, which is true. In 1991, in the Persian Gulf War, when the American ground attack was launched into Kuwait and Iraq, I rode with the 24th MEC Infantry Division in the wide end run through the western Iraq desert. It was pure cavalry, a bold and daring dash into the enemy's rear, coming at him out of a desert so inhospitable that the enemy, though he owned it, never went there and didn't bother to watch it, since he didn't believe anyone could cross it. Well, we crossed it, but it was one hell of a ride. I was in the back seat of a Humvee, crowded in with assorted packs and boxes of supplies, my feet in that little bitty well back there, eating dust the whole way. There was a column of M1A1 tanks 50 meters to my right, another 50 meters to my left. I've never felt safer or dirtier in my life. Finally, after 27 nonstop hours of driving through the desert and the rock fields, we reached a first logger point, a place to stop and rest somewhat. And right then and right there, it started to rain on us in the middle of this desert where it never rains. We sat in our vehicle in a state of advanced stupor. Another Humvee pulled up. The driver opened his door and he yelled out, "Is there a Mr. Galloway in that vehicle?" The driver of my vehicle, an admin captain who had been pressed into duty as a public affairs escort, shouted back that there was. The reply, "Well, the general would like to speak to him." I grabbed my pack and began unwinding from that vehicle. The captain sneered as he said, "This is going to be the shortest interview in history. That general doesn't speak to media pukes." 3 hours later, the general and I were still talking. We had disposed of the current war in half an hour and had moved on, or back, if you will, to Vietnam. I asked him what Vietnam meant to him. He replied, "It's one of the two defining moments in my life, and what it's given me is a bulletproof filter through which I can see and judge men and events. Isn't it the same for you? I nodded. I said it was. And then, like a good reporter, I asked him, tell me, what's that second defining event? He looked a little shocked, and he hesitated a moment. And then he said these words, that defining moment in my life has been raising my second daughter, who is a Down syndrome child. I'm a military man, and what we are all about is the pursuit of perfection. But raising that child has taught me there's more than one way to judge perfection. And then it was my turn to be stunned and amazed and to wipe tears off my face. I thought then, and I think now, how very well we as a nation have been served by the young officers who were blooded on the fields of Vietnam. Those officers are now very near the end of their active duty service, and soon there will be no one in the forces who lived through those terrible days and nights. No one who understands that some wars can drag on for years and wipe out the ranks of the platoons and companies over and over and still end in bitter defeat because the politicians lied to the American people and they abandoned support of the effort. I would like to, if you will indulge me, I would like to move into this phase by reading you the prologue to my book. This year we will have our 35th anniversary reunion of the Odrang Valley battles. I find it astounding. That's a long time ago. America was a different place. We were a different people. And this prologue was really written to sort of introduce the unknowing reader to that time and to that place and to those people. And so, if you don't mind, I will read it to you. And it opens with this quotation from Henry IV, Shakespeare. In thy faint slumbers, I by thee have watched and heard thee murmur tales of iron wars. This story is about time and memories. The time was 1965, a different kind of year, a watershed year when one era was ending in America and another was beginning. We felt it then in the many ways our lives changed so suddenly, so dramatically. And looking back on it from a quarter century gone, we are left in no doubt. It was the year America decided to directly intervene in the Byzantine affairs of obscure and distant Vietnam. It was the year we went to war. In the broad traditional sense, that we who went to war was all of us, all Americans. Though in truth, at that time, the larger majority had little knowledge of, less interest in, and no great concern with what was beginning so far away. So this story is about the smaller, more tightly focused we of that sentence. The first American combat troops who boarded World War II troop ships sailed to that place and fought the first major battle of a conflict that would drag on for 10 long years and come as near to destroying America as it did to destroying Vietnam. The Odrang campaign was to the Vietnam War what the terrible Spanish Civil War was in the 1930s to World War II. A dress rehearsal, the place where new tactics, techniques, and weapons were tested, perfected, and validated. In the Odrang, both sides claimed victory and both sides drew lessons, some of them dangerously deceptive, which echoed and resonated throughout the decade of bloody fighting and bitter sacrifice that was to come. This is about what we did, what we saw, what we suffered in a 34-day campaign in the Odrang Valley of the Central Highlands of South Vietnam in November 1965 when we were young and confident and patriotic and our countrymen knew little and cared less about our sacrifices. Another war story, you say? Not exactly, for on the more important levels, this is a love story, told in our own words and by our own actions. We were the children of the 1950s, and we went where we were sent because we loved our country. We were draftees, most of us, but we were proud of the opportunity to serve that country, just as our fathers had served in World War II, our older brothers in Korea. We were members of an elite experimental combat division trained in the new art of air mobile warfare at the behest of President John Kennedy. Just before we shipped out to Vietnam, the Army handed us the colors of the historic 1st Cavalry Division, and we all proudly sewed on the big yellow and black shoulder patches with the horse head silhouette. We went to war because our country asked us to go, because our new president, Lyndon Johnson, ordered us to go, but more importantly, because we saw it as our duty to go. That's one kind of love. Another and far more transcendent love came to us unbidden on that battlefield, as it does on every battlefield and every war man has ever fought. We discovered in that depressing, hellish place where death was a constant companion that we loved each other. We killed for each other, we died for each other, we wept for each other, and in time we came to love each other as brothers. In battle, our world shrank to the man on the left, the man on our right, and the enemy all around. We held each other's lives in our hands, and we learned to share our fears, our hopes, our dreams, as readily as we shared what little else good came our way. We were the children of the 1950s and John Kennedy's young stalwarts of the 60s. He told the world that Americans would pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship in defense of freedom. We were the down payment on that costly contract, but the man who signed it was not there when we fulfilled his promise. Jack Kennedy waited for us on a hill in Arlington Cemetery, and in time we came by the thousands to fill those slopes with our white marble markers and to ask on the murmur of the wind if that was truly the future he had envisioned for us. Among us were old veterans, grizzled sergeants who had fought in Europe and the Pacific in World War II, had survived the frozen hell of Korea, and now were about to add another star to their combat infantry badge. There were regular Army enlistees, young men from America's small towns whose fathers told them they would learn discipline and become real men in the Army. There were other young men who chose the Army over an equal term in prison. Alternative sentencing, the judges call it now. But the majority were draftees, 19 and 20-year-old boys summoned from all across America by their local selective service boards to do 2 years in green. The PFCs soldiered for $99.37 a month, the sergeant's first class for $343.50 a month. Leading us were the sons of West Point and the young ROTC lieutenants from Rutgers and the Citadel and, yes, even Yale University, who had heard Kennedy's call and answered it. There were also the young enlisted men and NCOs who passed through officer candidate school and emerged, newly minted, officers and gentlemen. They laughed nervously when confronted with the cold statistics that measured a second lieutenant's combat life expectancy in minutes and seconds, not hours. The second lieutenants were paid $241.20 a month. The class of 1965 came out of the old America, a nation that disappeared forever in the smoke that billowed off the jungle battlegrounds where we fought and bled. The country that sent us off to war was not there to welcome us home. It no longer existed. We answered the call of one president who was now dead, followed the orders of another who would be hounded from office and haunted by the war he mismanaged so badly. Most of our countrymen came to hate the war we fought. Those who hated it the most, the professionally sensitive, were not, in the end, sensitive enough to differentiate between the war and the soldiers who had been ordered to fight that war. They hated us as well, and we went to ground in the crossfire as we had learned in the jungles. In time, our battles were forgotten, our sacrifices discounted, and both our sanity and suitability for life in polite American society were publicly questioned. Our young old faces, chiseled and gaunt from the fever and the heat and the sleepless nights, now stare back at us, lost and damned strangers, frozen in yellowing snapshots packed away in cardboard boxes with our medals and ribbons. We rebuilt our lives, found jobs or professions, married, raised families, and waited patiently for America to come to its senses. As the years passed, we searched each other out and found that the half-remembered pride of service was shared by those who had shared everything else with us. With them and only with them could we talk about what had really happened over there, what we had seen, what we had done, what we had survived. We knew what Vietnam had been like and how we looked and acted and talked and smelled. No one in America did. Hollywood got it wrong every damn time, whetting twisted political knives on the bones of our dead brothers. So once, just once, this is how it all began, what it was really like, what it meant to us, and what we meant to each other. It was no movie. When it was over, the dead didn't get up and dust themselves off and walk away. The wounded did not wash away the red and gone with life unhurt. Those who were miraculously unscratched were by no means untouched. Not one of us left Vietnam the same young man he was when he arrived. This story, then, is our testament and our tribute to 234 young Americans who died beside us during 4 days in Landing Zone X-Ray and Landing Zone Albany in the Valley of Death, 1965. That is more Americans than were killed in any regiment, north or south, at the Battle of Gettysburg, and far more than were killed in combat in the entire Persian Gulf War. 70 more of our comrades died in the Ya Drang in desperate skirmishes before and after the big battles. All of the names, 305 of them, including one Air Force pilot, are engraved on the third panel to the right of the apex, panel 3 east, of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., and on our hearts. This is also the story of the suffering of families whose lives were forever shattered by the death of a father, a son, a husband, a brother in that place. While those who have never known war may fail to see the logic, the story also stands as tribute to the hundreds of young men of the 320th, 33rd, and 66th Regiments of the People's Army of Vietnam who died by our hand in that place. They too fought and died bravely. They were a worthy enemy. We who killed them pray that their bones were recovered from that wild, desolate place where we left them and taken home for decent burial. This is our story and theirs, for we were soldiers once and young. So I hope that sort of sets the stage a little bit, and I'll tell you something about the battle and the remarkable men that I met there. On the 13th of November, 1965, I had gone out to the Kateka tea plantation, which had been attacked the night before, and I had gathered up some information for a story, and then I heard that they were sending a battalion of the 7th Cav out on an operation, a helicopter lift, 15, 16, 17 miles west into a trackless wilderness the following morning. And I talked to Colonel Brown, the brigade commander, and I said, I'd like to go on that. And he said, well, hang around, and we'll see you in the morning. And the next morning, these guys were loading up, and I tried to load up with them, and the colonel said, oh, no. He said, stay here. They're probably going to have a walk in the sun. And if anything happens, you can fly in with me. So I stood back, stood down. And a little bit after noon, the radios came alive in the tactical operations center, and there was contact. There was heavy contact. There was heavier contact. There were beginning to be calls for reinforcements. And the colonel came racing out of his headquarters heading for his chopper and waved me aboard, and off we went. So the colonel dropped me in an artillery fire base about 5 miles away where the 105 howitzers were shooting from. And I spent that afternoon desperately trying to find a helicopter going that way and not having any luck until I ran across Captain Matt Dillon, Colonel Moore's S2. And I said, Matt, how do I get in there? And he says, well, as soon as it's dark, I'm going in with a two-ship lift of ammo and water, but I can't take you without the old man's say-so. And I said, well, get him on the horn. And Dillon got on the radio, and he said, Colonel Moore, I'm coming in as soon as it's dark. I'm bringing in two choppers full of ammo and water, and I'm bringing in the artillery liaison, the air liaison, myself. Oh, yeah, and there's this reporter, Galloway, wants to come along. And Hal Moore, the crackle back over the radio, he said, well, if he wants to come in here, if he's crazy enough to want to come in here and you have room, bring him along. And so my ride into the pages of history began right there. We flew in there that night, bailed out of this. I was seated on a case of hand grenades. Now, that's not too smart, going into a hot landing zone, but that's what there was to sit on, so that's what I sat on. We bailed out of the chopper. We drug out all the water and the ammo and threw it in the tall grass. We were in grass waist high, a little higher, and we fell down into that grass and waited for the choppers to go out. And A voice came out of the darkness and said, "Follow me, I'll take you to the command post. Watch where you're stepping. There are a lot of bodies in the grass, and they're all ours." And I thought, my, my. We got over to a clump of trees, and I got a short welcome handshake and a short briefing from Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore. And I sat back against a tree trunk with my M16 across my lap, and I thought, by God, Galloway, you have gotten lucky. You've got the world in a jug and a cork in your hand. You have an exclusive seat at a historic battle. And I thought, this is good. And I thought that until about sunup, when two battalions of the North Vietnamese Army attacked the southeast perimeter. And everything they were firing at Charlie Company, which they were in the process of semi-overrunning, that didn't take effect, flew through Hal Moore's command post. And his radio operator took a hit on his helmet, fell over. We thought he was dead. And I was laying flat, and the bullets were just screaming through there. I didn't know there were that many bullets in the world, and why were they all aiming at me? And about then, I felt a thump in my ribs. And I looked down, and it was a boot, a combat boot, and it was very large. And it was attached to the leg, attached to the trunk, attached to Sergeant Major Basil L. Plumley out of West Virginia. A fearsomely large fellow he was, and he bent at his waist. It was horribly noisy. And he shouted down at me, and what he said was, "You can't take no pictures laying down there on the ground, sonny." It was what they would call an epiphanous moment. I thought about that, and I thought two things. I thought, first of all, I think we're all going to die here. This doesn't look good at all. There aren't that many of us, and there seem to be a hellish amount of them. And second of all, if I'm going to die here, I think I would like to take mine standing up alongside the sergeant major. And so I did. I got up, and I walked along beside him, and I was astounded to see him. He was a very, you know, yo maitre call me laconic. He's never met Sergeant Major Plumley. Plumley is not a demonstrative fellow. But he reached down, and he pulled out his .45, and he jacked around into the chamber. And he went over to what passed for our aid station. And the battalion surgeon, Dr. Carrera, was there, and Sergeant Keaton, the medical sergeant, and all the rest of the people who normally would be there had been assigned out as medics to the companies because the battalion was sorely under strength and had to leave a lot of medics behind when they went to Vietnam. And he went over there, and he said these words, getting once again down in the doctor's face. He said, "Gentlemen, prepare to defend yourselves." And the doc, who had been given a set of captain's bars straight out of medical school and a little time down in San Antonio, was astounded. His jaw fell open just like mine did. The sergeant major, who was a four-jump veteran of World War II with the 82nd Airborne and had made another combat jump in Korea with the 187th, knew something. He knew we were looking like getting overrun. And he was gathering up a battalion reserve. And I was part of it. I thought that was pretty high speed. It's interesting. You sit in something like that. I look at the old film. There were a couple of Army cameramen in there who shot 17 minutes of color silent 16-millimeter film. And I look at our faces, and I know what the sounds were like and the smells. But everybody looks calm, totally unnaturally calm, like this was an exercise or a Sunday picnic or something, and terrible things were happening all around us. Men were dying. Heroic deeds were being done. People say, would you still get on that helicopter and go back in there? Yes, I would, with no guarantee of survival. Still, I would go. Still, I think any of us who went and survived would go for the privilege of standing alongside the sort of men we were allowed to serve with, to see terrible things, but to see also wonderful things, to see heroism of an order that is almost indescribable, to see men give the one true thing, their life, to save a comrade. There are lessons also for you to draw from this battle, these battles, these men. On the 16th of November, when they left, I left. And what I knew is that I was leaving, that UPI was probably going to allow me maybe 1,200 words to tell this story. And I knew that surely wasn't enough. And so I said, you know, Colonel, someday we may have to write a book about this. And we shook hands, and I got on my helicopter, and he got on his. But we stayed in touch. After we began the research on the book, Cal Moore and I went to Hanoi, and we sat down three different times with the enemy commanders who fought against us, from General Giap to General Chu Hui Man to General Nguyen Hu An. And the guy I liked the best was a Major General Huang Phung, who was the chief of military history of the North Vietnamese Army when we went there. He had actually been sent down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, arriving in the valley in November of 1965, tasked by their army to write an after-action report and lessons learned of the battle they knew they were going to have with us. And that's what he did. He had a wide-ranging latitude to interview their commanders on the field. And in a matter of 45 days, they had produced a pamphlet, which they circulated to all their troops, how to fight the American helicopters. How to fight the American helicopters. The lessons being, move in, get the Americans by the belt buckle. You have to get in under their ring of firepower. If you do, then it's man to man. Then we're all even. These are things that we learn from. These form us and shape us and make us who we are and what we are. Thank you all. Thank you very much.
That was war correspondent Joseph Galloway with the Pershing Memorial Military Lecture. The battle he described took place in 1965. Now joining me are two men who fought very different wars in Vietnam. From the University College of Communication, Chief Engineer Carlo Durante, who served with the United States Marines from 1966 to 1967 for a total of 13 months in Vietnam. From the College of Arts and Sciences, Professor of International Relations Andrew Basevich, who served as an armored officer in Vietnam from 1971 to 1972. They agreed to talk with me about their experiences, how they dealt with them, and what they think now, 25 years later. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
Let me begin by asking you about your service in Vietnam. Could you briefly describe what you did, Andy?
I had attended the military academy for my undergraduate years, so I was commissioned in Armor Branch in June of 1969. After my commissioning, we had to go through some training, and so it was not until June of 1970 that I deployed. I served my entire year in what was then called Two Corps, basically in the central highlands of South Vietnam. Yeah, in two different units, both of them armored cavalry units.
Carlo, what was your duty?
Joined the Marine Corps in 1965, went through infantry training, was assigned to a logistics supply unit. 6 months later, I was assigned to Vietnam. I originally got located in Phu Bai, which is about 40 miles north of Da Nang, into a logistic supply unit in short period of time, and we had a lieutenant assigned to our group. He got involved in the Open Arms program, which was called the Chu Hoi program, resettlement camps for former Viet Cong. And then we were doing medical relief operations in different villages, and it pretty much got hairy on different occasions.
That's a word that you would probably use, Andy, to describe some of your experiences.
Oh, I suppose so. But as I reflect on Vietnam, I don't know who said this, but somebody in explaining the failure of U.S. military policy in Vietnam once remarked that Vietnam wasn't a 10-year war for the United States. It was a one-year war that we basically fought 10 times because we were constantly rotating people in and out of country. So there was not a great fund of experience available at any particular time. And I make that point because the more I've thought about the war, the more it seems to me that the experience itself varied tremendously from year to year and from place to place. My experience, an experience that happened when Nixon was already president, an experience that coincided with the Vietnamization program of turning the war back over to the Vietnamese and drawing down the U.S. Combat presence, was not one that involved the kind of intense combat operations that tended to characterize the period of 65, 66, 67, and up to Tet. When I served, it was already understood that the policy was a failed policy, that the war was not going to be won in any sense of what that term generally means in military history. And therefore, the object of the exercise was to try to disengage as gracefully as possible, to do it without incurring any unnecessary additional casualties. When I served, it was a time of tremendous demoralization within the United States military, and I think particularly in the United States Army. During my year, frankly, we were troubled as much by the rampant drug abuse in our own ranks and by the just horrific racial tensions as much as we were by the enemy.
Carlo, you served in 66, 67, but you said that as soon as you arrived, you thought that the whole thing was out of joint. Can you explain that?
Well, my observation was that when I originally landed in Fubai, I just looked around. I was watching some of the villages and people just moving around, and I just wondered what the connection was between our society and their society. And as I spent, obviously, more time there, I got more acquainted with their society. And it seemed to be a very two-tiered society where you had 80, 90% agricultural and 10% elite. And there was a big disparity between the two different groups of people and how they looked at each other.
What did you say to the general when he stopped to inspect you at Phu Bai?
Well, it was sort of an off-comment remark that I shouldn't have made, but I did anyway. He had stopped. There was an inspection, and they usually move across and stop in front of someone, doesn't matter, randomly. And he asked me how I was doing, a couple of general questions, and I said, well, could I ask you a question? And he said, sure. And I said, if I get killed tomorrow morning, does anybody care?
Was your attitude typical of the guys in the unit that you served with?
I think everybody was under stress. I mean, you know, every night it's incoming rockets. You got mortars. You're on the main perimeter. You're outrunning ambushes. Situation is monsoon season, or you're in 120-degree heat, sweating to death, or you're freezing to death. Not quite freezing, but you're pretty miserable. And, you know, it gets tensed. I mean, you get incoming rockets. I had one particular night. We were on the main perimeter, and the CBs were working on. We had a short runway where helicopters landed and small planes. I said, so the CBs are out there working. They got these big quartz lights on. Obviously, the Viet Cong decided to zero in on them. So we're about 300 or 400 yards in front of them on the main perimeter. So I'm sitting there about 2 o'clock in the morning, heating up a cup of coffee in my little tin can. I hear the first rocket come in. Fell shot behind me. Then I says, well, I guess I know where they're going for the CBs. Second rocket lands on the runway. The CBs come running towards the main perimeter. So these CBs jump in a hole, and they're yelling and screaming at us, saying, you're supposed to protect us. So I woke up one of the other Marines and said to them, I guess we're supposed to be protecting them.
So it never really made sense. That's what I'm hearing from both of you.
I had one particular experience I don't know about other people. We had a Vietnamese boot camp to the right of our area. So one day I was on the main gate on Highway 1, which we sort of blocked the main highway.
By a boot camp, you mean where they're training South Vietnamese soldiers?
Absolutely.
To go out into the field and defend their own country.
So one morning I was up there, and one of the guys said, well, this is your first time out here, so I want you to watch this. And I says, what? He says, do you see the obstacle course on the other side of the road? And I said, yeah. So a whole, must have been a platoon of South Vietnamese Army troops in training, go across the street and start walking around the obstacle course.
The same course that you had to run through.
Back in Parris Island.
With sergeants screaming at you all
Absolutely.
The way.
Absolutely.
So the training was not intensive. The effort was not serious. Now, you were involved in Vietnamization, Andy. Did you have problems in training and turning over your unit?
My relations with the Vietnamese, we lived among them and had frequent personal contacts. In retrospect, what strikes me, and again, this is a 1970 perspective, not necessarily a 1966 perspective, is the great contempt that we felt towards the Vietnamese people and Vietnamese soldiers, as Carlo was just suggesting. We thought they were lazy. We thought they were dishonest. We couldn't understand why their efforts to defend their country seemed to be so inadequate. And I'm struck by that now because since the war ended, since I've had the opportunity, the great opportunity, to get to know quite a number of Vietnamese Americans, the people who came from Vietnam to the United States, since then, one's impression is what wonderful people they are. And how attractive, how smart, how talented, how devoted to the sort of values that one admires and perhaps shares. And I sort of scratch my head saying, I don't understand. How is it that did we completely misunderstand who they were? Did we make them what they were by our own presence and by the way we had basically shoved them aside in order to take responsibility for the war? To me, it just remains a puzzle.
Which experiences in Vietnam made the deepest impression on you as you think back?
Well, for me, I think it was that in my unit, in broad daylight, an American soldier murdered his troop commander, his captain, shot him on the base camp with an M-16, again in broad daylight, black soldier, white officer. And that, to me, is the great symbol of the terrible situation that had evolved by the time we had gotten to this last portion of this failed war.
What were the consequences?
Well, the soldier was court-martialed. If I remember correctly, he was got a 15-year sentence for probably was the equivalent of second-degree murder. Morale and discipline of the unit, which was never particularly strong, certainly was that much more battered. The sense of distrust between leaders and soldiers was damaged, I would say, irreparably. And it just, I think, probably reinforced an attitude which said that the definition of success is getting through this year and getting out of here, which, of course, is a definition of success that does not make for effective units.
How did you deal personally with these events as they happened around you?
Probably just get by, I guess, sorry to say. You know, live for the day and do your time and move on, because there really wasn't much you can do. Like I say, the system, you couldn't really help.
Why did you go to West Point, Andy?
I mean, sort of typical kid growing up middle class in the Midwest. Both my parents were veterans of World War II. So I think that the household was sort of imbued with patriotism, I was, I think, attracted to the sense of order and purposefulness that at least appears to be part of military life. It's not necessarily that way viewed from the inside, so I took a flyer at getting an appointment and was fortunate enough to succeed.
The experiences shortly after graduation then must have cut you to the quick.
Well, they did. I mean, you mentioned before that when we were there, didn't some of the experiences suggest that it didn't make any sense? And in a sense, early in the war, it did make sense. And of course, Carlo's early in the war is he's in the war. My early in the war is I'm a cadet at the military academy up on the Hudson River, reading the New York Times every morning and sort of still being at one and the same time part of the military but still within American society. And so from that vantage point back here in the United States, let's say in 66 and 67, there still is a story that's plausible. I mean, the story is one of communist aggression and the defense of freedom and a war that is somehow part of a larger strategy, and the strategy is at least defensible. Well, by the time you get past 68, then the story all falls apart. Johnson's withdrawal from the campaign, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, which don't necessarily have much to do with Vietnam directly, but contribute to that and other things, contribute to that sense within the country that it's really starting to unravel. Well, in 68, I'm still sitting up there in the Hudson River, still part of American society, and now the story falls apart. It's only after that, of course, that I graduate and go to Vietnam. So by the time I get to Vietnam, I don't have a story to tell myself that causes it to make sense. And so I think that I got through my year by really asking as few questions as possible of myself. Just do your job best you can, get through this, and see what comes next.
You spent your time as a ground pounder, Carlo, and you were getting by before you ever went. You joined the Marines because the draft was breathing down your neck and you could get a 2-year enlistment. How were you treated on your return at the end of 67?
Pretty poorly. I think most people really didn't have much respect for the military between the newspapers publishing articles about baby killings and, you know, misled information. And most people just looked as a veteran as just a piece of trash.
But you came back to East Boston, and you came out of that let's join the Marines culture.
In East Boston, in the neighborhoods that you grew up with, people respected you.
Andy, you came back from that experience and continued in the military as a career. Was it a conflicted career? Let me put it this way. How did you deal? How were you treated upon your return?
Well, I certainly didn't have any of the experiences of people overtly showing disrespect to me. My sense of it was that, well, first of all, there was a sort of a general, one had a general sense that the culture, whatever that means, disapproved, did not think well of people who had anything to do with the military or who had served in Vietnam. Now, how much of that perspective was an accurate reading of the culture, and how much of that was those of us who are veterans somehow misconstruing things to some degree is a worth debating, I think.
Our guests are Andy Basevich of the Center for International Relations and Carlo Durante, a former Marine from the College of Communication. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Carlo, what happened when you came back? Did you just forget it, put it behind you, bury it, what?
Well, you know, it took a few years to sort of get past it. You know, you come back, you're restless, you don't sleep well, it's a lot of things bother you. It took several years for me to sort of calm down and put it past me. But it's difficult because there are quite a few people that got killed over there and maimed. I had friends of mine from East Boston that were killed, so it took a while.
Have any of the stories or movies or television programs about this war resonated with you in any way?
I guess maybe Full Metal Jacket and Platoon. It got close. I think Platoon probably got a lot more closer.
Andy?
To reality.
Probably, what was it, Deer Hunter? Because that was a film that sort of, to some degree, captured the Vietnam during the war as a bizarre and sort of inexplicable and crazed kind of environment. I mean, not that we played Russian roulette, but that it was strange in a way.
Were there any lessons that you can look back now from 2000 and say, this is what the country learned from this, or this is what we took away from it?
From the vantage point of the year 2000, I'm struck by the extent to which, although the war remains an experience that's not fully digested by the country, there are still differences that we prefer to not attend to, better to leave them aside rather than to really engage the differences of view. I'm struck in the year 2000 by the extent to which really we've begun to forget lessons. The same sort of hubris that informed the policymaking world in the early 60s.
Halberstam's Best and Brightest.
And it led the best and the brightest to think that this was, an important war, and B, one that American know-how and American technology could win. I find that same sort of hubris in evidence in Washington today. When you listen to Madeleine Albright proclaim the United States to be the indispensable nation, when you listen to the president chastising others for not being on what he calls the right side of history, whereas we are, of course, on the right side of history. When you read the doctrine coming out of the Pentagon and talking about how American military power has the capacity to shape, that's their term, shape the international environment, those sort of references to me echo the period that got us into Vietnam and caused me to be somewhat concerned. So I think the big question is, are we already forgetting the lessons rather than what are those lessons?
Carlo, lessons learned, lessons lost?
Oh, well, I don't think force is the answer because, you know, you get into a situation in a country that's, you know, the people are not committed. You don't have that support. And if you don't have a country that's committed, you're not going to go anywhere with it.
Well, finally, one last question. Joseph Galloway in his speech said his experience in the Odrang Valley gave him a standard by which to judge men and situations for the rest of his life. Is that true of you?
Well, it was a big learning curve for me, and you know, about getting involved into wars and situations that we really couldn't do much with.
Okay. Andy, what about you?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that combat is a unique environment. I mean, the rest of one's life is full of other experiences and situations that may not have quite the same intensity, but have their own particular importance and make their own demands. And so the demonstrations of courage or integrity or leadership that one sees in combat don't necessarily translate to courage and integrity and leadership as evinced in other environments. So I've seen a lot of those qualities in a positive sense. I've seen the absence of those qualities, and I don't know that one has to go back to one's own combat experience to find them.
Our guests have been Professor Andrew Bacevich of the Center for International Relations and Carlo Durante, Chief Engineer of the School of Communication. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us and participating.
My
pleasure. Thank you.
Join us next week for a roundtable discussion on college admissions with experts from University Admissions and High School Guidance, as well as a newspaper reporter who has written widely on the subject. That's next week on Boston University's World of Ideas. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-WBUR. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Micheline Boudreau, Tad Curry, and Sean Cole. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.